Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about full focus on the Constitution, which is one of the reasons why we go through all of the primary source documents to help you understand exactly how we evolved from colonies in the British Empire into a confederation, into the Articles of Confederation, a very limited confederation, then into the Articles of Confederation, which were equally impotent and inept, and evolved into a whole new form and framework of government. And that evolution is where we're actually in that process of evolving towards the Constitution. So we are helping you with the content so that you can understand how important it is to utilize those processes that are actually baked into this government and this framework. You know, the convention of state folks, those people who are basically saying, hey, the Article 5 convention is the only process in the Constitution that is the process of, you know, holding government accountable, and they're not being, they're actually being dishonest. They're being disingenuous at best. And so the process of holding government accountable is in the Bill of Rights. The right of the people to petition government for the redress of grievances. We have to get into their grill. We don't ask a bunch of delegates to go make changes to the Constitution, which is why when we went through the five documents, the critical five documents, the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions of 98, the Kentucky Resolutions of 99, Madison's notes, Madison's report first, on the Virginia Resolutions, and then the Madison's notes on nullification. Those five documents literally prove why you don't call a convention when the Constitution is being violated. And so, you know, when you look at the Federalist Papers, by the way, Madison pointed to the Articles, he pointed in Article number 49, the methodology of dealing with encroachments by using conventions. What is expelled or what is explained or what is elucidated in the very first paragraph of Federalist Paper number 49? And you know I'm not a fan of the Federalist Papers because they're a poisonous pill. But they lay out that there are two types of conventions. Ones that deal with the modification or the amendments and the changing of the Constitution. The other one is to address the breaches thereof. In other words, those violations and breaches, that's not an Article 5 convention. This is a working of the states and forming this tribunal, which is why him and Jefferson did what they did. Why they didn't use the Article 5 process, they sought a convention, because when you read we read this already, but when you read the Kentucky Resolutions of 98, when Jefferson was calling upon the states to establish committees of conference of correspondence, that right there was basically calling upon the states to get organized, to start communicating and convening fundamentally a convention where the states start talking about the problem. You can't fix a problem until you start talking about it. So anyway, welcome back, Sean. Now, Sean and I have been covering along with Tammy, last episode we had Tammy with us, and we were going through the amendments of the Articles of Confederation. And we were currently going through the 8th submitted amendment to the Articles of Confederation, and that amendment was actually, and I think we covered this before, but it's worth repeating that this amendment was basically promulgated. In other words, they finished it and sent it out for review on the 7th of August, 1786. Now, when we look at the timeline, and we're going to get into the timeline next, because that's exactly what we're going to dive into, the conversation of these amendments failing and failing and failing and failing. Now, when one looks at this particular amendment, Amendment 8, they're actually, and this is where we kind of covered all the way up to Article 16, they are suggesting that the following articles need to be added to the Constitution. Now, when I look at the U.S. Constitution, I think it comes down to like 10 pages with all of the signatures and everything else, a total of 10 pages. And when I look at the actual Articles of Confederation, and let me see if I can pull it back up, because I had it and it went away. So let me see, give me a second, folks. We'll get it up, and I'll tell you how many pages there are in the Articles of Confederation, because that way we can kind of look, because as we look at these articles, they're looking at adding four more pages, almost four more pages to the Articles of Confederation. And so, let me see here, right here, Articles of Confederation, that is a total of seven pages, four more pages, it makes it 11 pages. And so technically, when we really look at the meat of Article 1 to Article 7, I want to say that that right there, those pages probably come up to about eight when we look at those pages of the Constitution. I got it right in front of me. And actually, it is, let me see here, Article 7 is identified on it's actually on the 10th page. So what these men did was they not only made a massive wholesale change to the framework of government, they changed roles, responsibilities, and they organized it, and they took 13 articles, that's how many articles were in the Articles of Confederation, and they basically organized it and compressed it into seven. Think about that. They were able to take this disarray of things all over in these different articles, and in addition to being aware of the amendments that were already on the table, fitting that stuff in, they did it in less paper, less, space, and more concise, and by enumerating. In other words, they basically listed, they'll be able to do this, they shall have the power to do this, this is the standard, this is their responsibility, so forth and so on. As a matter of fact, it even identified the state's responsibilities as well. So I noticed, Sean, welcome back. So do you have anything to go over, or is there anything we need to add before we start diving into this set of amendments or these articles they wanted to add?
Yes, dismantle the educational industrial complex.
Okay. Yes, so we can talk all about that, but, and I think we already did. I don't know if you have any new light to that, but I mean that goes along with dismantling the Department of Energy, dismantling these. What you were saying was basically a I'll call it a vernacular or a way of speaking that Eisenhower put it to the nation to tell everybody to be very watchful, to understand that this military-industrial complex is, worth being scared of. Do you know when the department and who the president was that created the first footing of education in the federal government formally?
I'm going to guess that it was FDR.
No, it was Eisenhower. Okay. Eisenhower was the one, because actually the concept of education So it was the Department of Hugh, Health, Education, Welfare. So prior to the Department of Hugh, Health, Education, Welfare, the federal government just had these little programs here or there, but they weren't organized like creating the Social Security Administration or, you know, building upon and creating a monstrosity of the Department of Labor. That happened underneath Roosevelt. So Roosevelt did all sorts of things to expand, and it was in Roosevelt's tenure where they really started, and this is where the term cradle to grave, right, this concept of covering people from cradle to grave with insurance, whether that be the Social Security insurance as well as health insurance. Do you know who coined that phrase?
No, sir.
So if you open up the ninth petition, which is the Medical Freedom Petition, or the petition that calls out the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional and needs to be dismantled as well, when you look at that petition, you'll find that we identified the two senators that utilized that term, and actually the specific senator and both of these senators that kind of – these senators that started singing that chant, cradle to grave, these were Republican senators out of Montana. They were doctors, socialists. Socialism was already accepted, and government was moving forward on the wings of socialism, which is why Truman didn't get it done. Truman kind of ended the war, and Truman kind of set us down this path of, you know, dealing with peace and so forth. He actually started initiating this program of repelling invaders, which Ike took on and dubbed it Project Wetback, to basically go gather up all of the illegals, the invaders, and send them back to Mexico. Now, you can see that they took it to a new level after, you know, the Reagan era, in basically bringing people from all over South America, Central America, and so forth, Latin America. So anyway, isn't it interesting, though, that it was Ike in his first year, I think, as the President of the United States, signed into passage the creation of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And so the reason I'm belaboring this point is you identified it as the military-industrial complex of education, right?
Correct, sir.
All three of those departments created by Ike can easily be considered the industrial complex of healthcare and the industrial complex of welfare and the industrial complex of education. Now, folks, if you go and you add up those three industrial complexes and how much money they're costing you, the taxpayer, and they're not even in the Constitution, they make the Department of Defense look pathetic as far as budget-wise. I hope you understand this. In other words, that's how bad the tyranny, or how bad they've gone way out of whack on spending our money on things they have no authority to do. As a matter of fact, I do have the outlays, and I provided this before, and so I'm going to take a chance by opening up the outlays, because since you brought this up, I kind of want to do this. This is outlays by agencies, and this goes up to 2017. So in other words, at the end of the Obama era, because the ACA and everything else started kicking more and more and more with more and more costs. Remember, during COVID, the costs were actually going up. Why were these costs going up? Because they were basically giving the pass to insurance companies. Because what did the ACA do? It created a law that forced everybody to take healthcare insurance. It brought everybody into becoming customers of healthcare insurance, these private insurance companies. The intent was to dismantle the insurance companies altogether and create a single-payer system. In other words, they were going to take the profits out of all of this, but these companies needed to bleed every expendable dollar out of everybody's budget. This is really apropos, so I'm glad you brought this up. Because there's not a person out there today that is out in these exchanges created by the law that is not being bled to death by the increases all of a sudden of their health care insurance. And it's all unconstitutional. You shouldn't have to be paid. As a matter of fact, so there's this movement that calls people not to pay their taxes. You know what? Don't pay for health care insurance. Go down to the hospitals, cancel your health care. Hopefully you're not on Social Security or these things that mandate you have to be there, be on that stuff. And go down and, you know, just go to the hospital and just work with the hospital as an uninsured person, because they still allow invaders to be treated and they don't bill them. And so if you want to poke, because what this does is it hurts your local hospitals. But what it also hurts, because bottom line, if you're not paying the insurance company, if they lose you as a customer, that's money they're not getting. And if everybody actually canceled their health care insurance, because all of you that are buying out of the exchanges because you don't have an employer that's providing it for you, then now you're sending a message to say your obscene profits are unacceptable. This system is unacceptable. And then they need to turn to the states and say, you need to give us something that's not managed by the federal government that would be acceptable to where we can actually have, you know, a reasonable costing health care insurance. Because when you get the federal government to be involved in it, the cost goes up dramatically. And this is all by design. This is to destroy us. Anyway, let me give you, in 2017, the Department of Education, right here, their amount of money that they took was, up to 2017, on an annual basis, was $70 million. The Department of Health and Human Services was $1.2 billion. So that would be, basically, if we added it, let's just take it, $1.3 billion with education and healthcare. Now, healthcare, is that welfare included? I think that is. Health and Human Services includes healthcare, I think. Yeah, I would guess so. So that's $1.3 billion in 2017, and it's gone up dramatically since then. So what is the Department of Defense? The Department of Defense and military programs is $500 million in 2017. So was Eisenhower being misguided? Was that a sleight of hand? Was that, you know, this underhanded, hey, don't pay attention to what we just did behind the curtain over here. You need to worry about that Department of Defense because they're going to get out of hand. As a matter of fact, as I look in this column of what are the greatest costs to Americans today by unconstitutional spending, Health and Human Services by far is the greatest in 2017. As we look at the other ones, Social Security is the next one. It's almost $1 billion. And so
in fiscal year 2026, Health and Human Services discretionary funding was $108 billion.
Right. Okay. And so actually, the numbers I'm giving you are probably based on millions, so there's the decimals are probably in the wrong spot, but I wanted to give them to you equally. So in other words, the military, the defense system, or military defense, which is constitutional, folks, they have a responsibility of maintaining our militia and our strategic defense systems. And it's half in 2017. So what is the Department of Defense now?
I did not have the Department of Defense, but I can get it for you.
Okay, there we go. So apologize, you know, we have these dynamic conversations, so that sometimes we have to
look. No problem.
No, I'm apologizing to the listeners because dollars. How much?
$848.3 billion.
848, and how much was health and human services, or just health care, whatever?
Human services is $108 billion.
Uh-huh.
That includes NIH and ACF, the Department of Labor, 9.6, education, 67.0 billion.
Uh-huh. Okay, so as you start adding these things up, and I think the only reason why we see a real uptick in the Department of Defense is due to the fact that they are now controlling weather, the dues, and everything else that they're doing. They're creating new weapon systems to compete with the advances of China as well as Russia. But here's the thing, and I'll give you the 2017 budget because you don't have that. The 2017 budget, the outlays, what was spent that was considered constitutional spending was $1.5 trillion. The constitutional spending on unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, and powers was $3.1 trillion. 1.5 to 3.1, in other words, more than twice the amount of money that was unconstitutional in 2017 was being spent compared to the constitution. In other words, if we look at the revenue, the legitimate revenue that the federal government brought in 2017 was $2.2 trillion. At least that's what I remember it was. So in other words, we actually didn't need to take on a penny of debt to cover the actual cost of government. But because government is spending fraudulently on things that they don't have the authority to spend money on, well, then this is how we have this huge problem. And that's why they're taking on debt, because they're getting away with spending money they don't have the authority. Okay, every show I start this off, where that debt is fraud. If you go back throughout the times, all the way back to when they started taking on debt, created the Federal Reserve, and even before that, because the real problem began because of the Federal Reserve. So if you go back and you actually look at the debt, they've been spending money recklessly for 200 years, probably, practically, where we have no debt. Legitimate debt is not existence in, you know, what they've been spending. All of the debt has been spending on government they've been giving us that they have no authority to do. That's how I know that entire debt clock is fraud. Wipe it out, and then we can start actualizing Social Security, so over the next 20 years or whatever, we can basically retire, sunset that program. And we can move forward without having an albatross around the necks of our children and having to leverage their future to pay for the we had to have it generations. And when I say we had to have it generations, that goes all the way back to when they started spending in the beginning of the 1900s. There was that many generations that took, and it's got to stop. Anyhow, it's immoral that we're doing this. Now, without any further ado, let's dive into this amendment and Article 17. Please, sir. Thank you.
17. In any state from which time to time shall be found in our payments on any requisition in advance on an average of the payments made by the state shall be allowed an interest of blank percent per annum on her said advance sums or expenses, and the state from which from time to time shall be found in arrear on the principles aforesaid shall be charged with an interest of blank percent per annum on the sums in which she may be so in arrear.
So obviously, we didn't see this coming, but I think Eisenhower saw what the Department of Hugh was going to do. So we'll deal with our mistake, our shortcoming, right after this.
If you listen to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so our segments really go about 25 minutes, and I did not think, and I don't know about you, Sean, but I did not think that we talked, going over the budget stuff, 25 minutes worth. But, I, you know, time flies when you're complaining. Anyway, sorry about that, folks. And as a matter of fact, it's my bad. It's my show, my responsibility. I should have saw that. And as soon as, you know, Sean started reading and I looked, oh, no, I go, maybe he can do it. Not even close. And it was a short paragraph. So let's reread the 17th article again. And obviously they're putting in this blank, you know, percent per annum, as far as the interest and so forth, because they didn't want to basically come with a hard number. But to finish this amendment, they needed the state's inputs on what they would think would probably be acceptable. But go ahead and let's read 17 again. Thank you so much.
In any state which from time to time shall be found in her payments on any requisition in advance on an average of the payments made by the states shall be allowed an interest of blank percent per annum on her said advance sums or expenses, and the state which from time to time shall be found in arrear on the principles aforesaid shall be charged with an interest of blank percent per annum on the sums in which she may be so in arrears.
So in other words, they wanted to make sure that the states had a little bit of a voice in, you know, what they would be paid as a benefit by actually paying in advance, and by in arrears, how much they were going to be punished. You know, because somebody can easily come up with and just dictate, well, we're going to really punish you with 20%, and we're going to bless you with the 3%, you know, on your advances. So you get 3% interest on your advances, but we're going to kill you with 20% because you're late. We're going to punish you. And I mean, in other words, they wanted to make sure that the states bought into whether the punishment needed to be equal to the blessings or the benefits, and vice versa, what have you. They wanted them to set that stage. Okay, so Article 18. Go ahead.
In case it shall hereafter be found necessary by Congress to establish any new systems of revenue and to make any new regulations in the finances of the U.S. for a limited term not exceeding 15 years in their operation for supplying the common treasury with monies for defraying all charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare, in such new system or regulation shall be agreed to and adopted by the United States and Congress assembled, and afterwards be confirmed by the legislatures of the 11 states, and in that proportion of 11 states, not the 11 states, and in that proportion when there shall be more than 13 states in the Union, the same shall become binding on all the states as fully as if the legislatures of all the states should confirm the same.
Okay. All right. So they're bringing up this clause of the common defense and general welfare. Do you see that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so as they're talking about establishing a new system of revenue and making new regulations, this they're doing this, and the justification for doing this and bringing these monies in to do this were to support this common defense and general welfare. But that was not to support uncontrolled spending. They could only spend the money on those things that were considered within, you know, the enumerated powers within this Articles of Confederation. Therefore, it wasn't pointing to general powers. As a matter of fact, this is where Madison pointed out in the ratification debates that nobody challenged that line, you know, to tax for the common defense and general welfare as a general power. It was never construed that, oh, now they can just tax you for whatever they want and spend it on whatever they want. No, it was never construed that way as a general power. So, in other words, the anti-federalists were going into the realm of hyperbole, of basically making an exaggeration, you know, and amplifying something that was not properly, you know, in context to what it really was. They were redefining it. Article 19. Here we go. Let's do this one now.
The United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive power of declaring what offenses against the United States shall be deemed treason, and what offenses against the same misprision of treason, and what offenses shall be deemed piracy or felonies on the high seas, and to annex suitable punishments to all the offenses aforesaid, respectively, and power aforesaid respectively, and power to institute a federal judicial court for trying and punishing all officers appointed by Congress for all crimes, offenses, and misbehavior in their officers, and to which court an appeal shall be allowed from the judicial courts of the several states, in all causes wherein questions shall arise on the meaning and construction of treaties entered into by the United States with any foreign power, or on the law of nations, or wherein any question shall arise respecting any regulations that may hereafter be made by Congress relative to trade and commerce, or the collection of federal revenues pursuant to powers that shall be vested in that body, or wherein questions of importance may arise, and the United States shall be a party, provided that the trial of the fact by jury shall ever be held sacred, and also the benefits of the writ of habeas corpus, provided also that no member of Congress or officer holding any other office on the United States shall be a judge of said court, and the said court shall consist of 7 judges to be appointed from the different parts of the Union, to wit, 1 from New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, 1 from Massachusetts, 1 from New York and New Jersey, 1 from Pennsylvania, 1 from Delaware and Maryland, 1 from Virginia, and 1 from North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, and 4 of whom shall be a quorum to do business.
Interesting. So they're basically
that now, huh?
Yeah, so, and it's kind of interesting how they created a representation for the court. In other words, a judge had to represent those states. Remember we talked about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because it's my suggestion, folks, that we have 50 judges, and that each state appoints their own judge, and that the Chief Justice would be appointed by the President of the United States, and it would be done so at the beginning of his election if he chooses to change the Chief Justice. Because if he, you know, does a re-election, then he can keep the same Chief Justice for 8 years. But there is no more lifetime permanency on the court, and that the court will actually be representative, because bottom line, by ensuring that the judges are actually coming from the states, that means that they will be representatives of the state, because it is their job to safeguard the state's sovereignty. They start pissing off the states by saying, hey, you're selling us downriver, we're pulling you, and give the states the power to actually remove their judge and replace them. This would create not a monstrosity, but if you look at the federal courts today, you would not need a district court. You would only need these segments of these courts to deal with, you know, if you want to break down the United States and these 50 judges into different panels for different issues. But when it came down to issues of the union that would affect the entire union, it would require the full body, the body of the whole, where all of these judges would debate the matter at hand and decide the matter at hand. Now, I'm also a fan of not doing popular vote. But bottom line, currently, the way it is a popular vote. I'm okay with actually getting away from the, you know, 50% plus one and make it a two-thirds if for the verdicts or what have you. Like when it's a jury trial, what is the parameters for a jury trial to issue a verdict of guilty? In many cases, it's unanimous. You have to get every juror to basically agree, because you can have a hung jury if one person with one. So we don't want to do that, because we already learned through unanimity that places like Rhode Island would undermine these attempts. So I think we need to probably look at a 60% or a two-thirds, but something greater than 50%. And by doing that, it would keep the progressive states from being able to amass a majority. In other words, it would require a true consensus across the union to say, you know, yea, verily, this was a violation of the Constitution, and this would need to happen. Just 2 cents to examine. But here they are. They're actually diving into the same things that was being covered in the following year in the Constitutional Convention, and how these things were literally being added into Article 3 and so forth. So let's do the 20th article and the last article. Thank you so much.
That due attention may be given to the affairs of the Union early in the federal year, and the sessions of Congress made as short as conveniently may be. Each state shall elect her delegates annually before the 1st of July, and make it their duty to give an answer before the 1st of September in every year, whether they accept their appointments or not, and make effectual provision for filling the places of those who may decline, before the 1st of October yearly, and to transmit to Congress by the 10th of the same month the names of the delegates who shall be appointed and accept their appointments. And it shall be the indispensable duty of delegates to make a representation of their state in Congress on the first Monday in November annually. And if any delegate or delegates, when required by Congress to attend so far as may be necessary to keep up a representation of each state in Congress, or having taken his or their seat, shall withdraw without leave of Congress unless recalled by the state, he or they shall be proceeded against as Congress shall direct, provided no punishment shall be further extended than to disqualifications any longer to be members of Congress, or to hold any office of trust or profit under the United States, or any individual state, and the several states shall adopt regulations effectual to the attainment of the ends of this article.
Interesting.
Like that one too.
Yeah, so you like this, huh? So this is kind of like Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but it's only affecting members of Congress. But do you understand the reason why they were doing this? Because I think I mentioned a few times that after the Articles of Confederation and Continental Congress formed, some of the states stopped paying. They didn't want to have this, you know, this requirement of filling these seats in the Continental Congress to be such a burden. So the states didn't want the Continental Congress to bleed them for money that they just didn't have the budget for. Which is why they said, you know what, we need to put this into law that you need to identify who it's going to be, and that person has to accept. And once they've accepted, then it's on them if they want. So this means that if they don't get paid by the state, they have to pay out of their pocket to be on travel, to be in Philadelphia or wherever they're going to be as Continental Congress. Wow. But they wanted to make sure that people took this seriously, because there were several states, or several, I should say, probably two or three, that were not showing up. I don't think Rhode Island was showing up at all. And then I think some states were actually seeking proxy of other states' delegates to vote for them on their behalf, to basically make it seem like, you know, they were getting votes out of Delaware that wasn't sending people, or Connecticut or what have you. I don't know who it was, but it was a problem. It was a real tangible problem, which is one of the reasons why it begged this amendment. Interestingly enough, at the very end, it basically, but it doesn't necessarily point to the oath. It just points to their desire to no longer live to the obligation of being present. You know, basically abandoning their post, that they would be banned from public service forever. Section 3 goes a little bit further than that. It's not just abandoning your post. It is literally violating the Constitution, or I should say your oath, where you're supposed to support it. You're not allowed to run an insurgency against the Constitution if you're under oath. Therefore, Section 3 kicks in and you're to be removed, blah, blah, blah. So anywho, any other comments?
No, it just seems... What looking at what's going on with current times right now, and what you were just discussing, mm-hmm. there's an insurrection all over the place right now. Uh-huh. It's just ridiculous. It's out of control. And knowing these things that we talk about and we discuss and we learn about, and looking at the actions of these so-called leaders that's going on right now, it's rampantly out of control.
Uh-huh. And so
people need to understand that and realize, you know, what we're barreling towards. And yes. If we don't take responsibility and exercise our authority and our duty as uh-huh. citizens, we're looking at some existential crossroads in the near future.
Okay. So as a matter of fact, every state is, you know, I think that there are too many states where the people are being so overwhelmed. Folks, you have no idea what it's like. If you're living in a red state, you have no idea what's happening in these blue states. Washington State and the state legislature is going wholesale bat crap crazy in violating their state constitution, the U.S. Constitution, and passing laws that are literally unconstitutional and literally waging lawfare and basically putting in measures of oppression so that the state and this small little, if you want to call them, this oligarchy of rulers within the state legislature, the governor, and the courts now rule and dictate. You're now their serfs. You're now their slaves. There have been comments about the Insurrection Act being, you know, executed, and that Trump deploying the National Guard or whatever forces. And I don't want to get into the speculation. I don't want to waste any time on that. What I want to do is, I think it's more important that we cover these documents so that we understand exactly why Madison and Jefferson did what they did. And we understand, more importantly, what they have the authority to do. Because that becomes the refiner. That becomes the sifter. That becomes the filter of what they can't do. In other words, if they can only do these things, everything else that they're doing is unconstitutional. is a violation of the law. And if we're not holding public servants accountable, and ergo, that last article was all about accountability, holding public servants accountable. You've heard us say this all the time. If we're not holding each other accountable, especially those who are serving us in our government, then we're getting the government we deserve. And if you want to change it, you don't go and you know, file in court to remove yourself as a citizen so you don't have to pay taxes. That's not a solution. That's making you a part of the problem. Because we need all hands on deck. We need everybody, you know, to lean into this and start pushing back and taking back our government. And it starts at the county level. Now, so the next thing that we're actually going to cover is this thing called the Annapolis, help me out here, the proceedings of the Annapolis commissioners, remedies, defects of the federal government, 1786, Annapolis in the state of Maryland. This was done on September 11th, 1786. Now, when we look at the proceedings, there was a proceeding that met before this one. And I think, if I remember correctly, they cited the previous one, but maybe they didn't. So I will need to go look. Well, probably Sean needs to, yeah, while Sean reads this. But in this Annapolis, there was a meeting before here, before this meeting, that kind of set the stage. And I think I told you this. That in this meeting, I think there were four states that were present. Let's look at it. New York was present with two members of New York, Alexander Hamilton and Egbert, and it's probably Egbert Benson. New Jersey was present with Abra Clark, William Chill Houston, and they're using these short, you know, names, you know, abbreviations, so forth. Mr. Sherman. For New Jersey, and that's not Sherman, the same spelling as Roger Sherman. Pennsylvania had one delegate there, so that's three. Delaware had four delegates, and Virginia had three delegates, so that's six. They still didn't have enough states there present. The states didn't take this meeting seriously. So they came up with these, I'll call them, you know, I don't want to say drastic. They basically said, Continental Congress, you need to put your foot down and you need to demand that all of the states attend the next convention in May of 1787. Now, I have to laugh because I get into, you know, this dumb space in social media or, you know, in private, you know, groups, meetings, what have you, where people come up with these concoctions of why the Constitutional Convention or, you know, what caused the Constitutional Convention. And I think the most cockamamie idea I have heard is the Shays Rebellion. Oh, that's what caused it. Are you serious? So the Shays Rebellion was, you know, this buildup of people that couldn't pay their taxes in Massachusetts. And it got that bad that they said, we can't do it. If you force us to pay taxes, you're going to kill us. So we might as well fight to the death. And then you won't have any money. So what are you going to do? I mean, they basically pushed back to make it an untenable situation. Rightfully so. However, then this goes back to what I said about Massachusetts. Massachusetts, for whatever reason, and I think it was the divine hand of providence, was the first victim by King George. It was obviously a state, it was a very small state, well populated, and very successful in its autonomy, its education, and in many things, but it did not have a lot of money. These people were just getting by. But they didn't want to have anything to do with the Union. These were the Puritans. These were the people that believed they were above everybody. They believed that they were, you know, following the pure practice of the, whatever that gospel was, whatever that was, that they were the ones. And so, I mean, does that not exude a level of arrogance, Sean?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I mean, in other words, they were kind of ripe for a little bit of humility. So to me, it just makes sense. Out of all of the states in the Union, this one state that really thought that they were righteously above everybody, they looked at everybody else as heathens, practically. And so they got their comeuppance, didn't they? So the war initiates there, and it becomes costly for them. And they need protection. They need more protection. And if you really think about it, when you look at the amount of time it takes to cross the Atlantic, because you know how the currents run with the Atlantic, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're clockwise.
The Gulf Stream, right.
Yeah, so they basically, to come to America out of Britain, they kind of sailed down the European western edge, France and so forth, and then they come across and they catch the current that takes them up. So if you're going to go to Massachusetts, you only have to go so far south, and then you come across. In other words, it is the shortest distance for the king to a major port, by the way. Boston was a major port. Anything north of Boston was minor ports. They didn't deal with a lot of commerce. Boston was capable of handling a lot of commerce, just like New York, and downstream with Virginia and so forth. So anyway, and back in those days, even Rhode Island had, you know, pretty serious ports because, you know, these were small bottom ships that could get into the rivers. Even Philadelphia had a port of entry where they were receiving their commerce directly via ships going up the river. So all this, and just imagine how difficult, because the navigation of going up those rivers was not by engine, it was by wind. And you had to be very good in your, you know, sailing and capturing that wind to go up a river that, you know, that you didn't get run aground, if you know what I mean. I mean, we're talking about some serious talent and so forth. But we're also talking about running out of time again. So we're going to dive into this, and I'll try to finish this summary when we come back. And I think we will probably have Tammy, God forbid, we, you know, don't lose her for the next segment or for the next show, because she, it's always nice to have the contributions of more. But anywho, with all of that, because I just want to wrap this up. And then, Sean, if you've got anything that you want to, you know, kind of bring and as a, you know, lingering and or a what we call, well, we call it something, a do-over, whatever, saved rounds. Anyway, we'll take care of that when we come back, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.